Sciences Po.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the third season of our Sciences Po research podcast, the podcast in which I, Sergei Guriev, the provost at Sciences Po, talk to Sciences Po faculty about their research on the most important issues that our societies are facing today. The first season was devoted to environmental transformation. The second season was concentrated on issues related to challenges to democracy coming from populist politicians and non-democratic regime. In the third season, we'll talk about the social science dimension of technological transformation. We are living through a rapid phase of digital transition where new technologies affect how we think about our societies, how politics works, how economics works. And today, I'm very happy to have with us Rafael Xenidis, who is Assistant Professor of European Law at Sciences Po's Law School. Rafael recently arrived at Sciences Po after finishing her PhD in European Law at the European University Institute. She's also studied political science. She has a master's degree in political science, among other things. So Rafael is working on very important issues of discrimination and, more recently, algorithmic discrimination in European law. Welcome to the podcast, Rafael.
Thank you, Sergei. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Rafael. So if a person in the street comes to you and asks you, what is algorithmic discrimination?
That's a very important question because obviously algorithms are used more and more in many domains of life. It can be, you know, fraud detection for social benefits or taxes. It can be policing. It can be the criminal sector. So there are many everyday areas of life where we are directly concerned by that. And the thing is that algorithms have proven to be extremely discriminatory. So face recognition systems are biased against racialized communities. In the healthcare sector, there has been studies proving that those algorithms target or allocate less resources to socioeconomically deprived communities or even, again, racialized communities. So those systems reproduce a lot the discriminations that pervade our societies. And this is why all of us are concerned by that issue.
So when we talk about specific examples, you mentioned face recognition. So I guess you're talking about systems which try to identify potential criminals or suspects. Why is that? Why are people coming from defavorized backgrounds? Why the algorithms are actually underserve them and disproportionately target them?
This is a reflection of how society works. So we should never forget that those algorithms are socio-technical systems. So not just a piece of, you know, technical innovation, so to say. So the discourse is really, you'll hear a lot of people saying, oh, you know, those systems are purely technical and therefore they are objective and neutral. Well, that's not the case because those systems serve specific socioeconomic goals, policy aims, etc. And so they reflect, first of all, this kind of rationality. So in tax detection systems, you can have, you know, logics of trying to, you know, to increase cost effectiveness in the public sector, for example. So those systems are already biased in a sense. And then those systems learn on social data. So there's this very famous formula in the field which says garbage in, garbage out. So obviously, if those systems are trained on data sets that reflect the underrepresentation of certain communities, they will learn to recognize faces, for example, in this specific case of white and white passing people much better than non-white people and communities. And then there's also an issue of interpretation. So the caseworkers that are in front of an algorithmic recommendation have to interpret it, obviously. And this can also be pervaded by stereotypes and prejudices. So you see that at every intersection of the socio-technical system, the algorithmic system reflects the kinds of biases that already pervade society.
So you're talking about two stages of discrimination. One is pre-algorithm, where human decision-making created the bias already before the algorithmic era. But you're also saying that, we train the data on pre-algorithmic epoch, pre-algorithmic times, and then these data come into algorithmic, as you magically described that, garbage in, garbage out, they come into the algorithm, algorithm spits out the results. And then you're saying that after that, you also have the case workers, people who are users of algorithms, who also are subject to biases and stereotypes, and that aggravates the situation. How do we address these two issues? So what can we do about the algorithmic discrimination because of being trained, algorithm being trained on biased data, and post-algorithm treatment of the outputs produced by the algorithm?
The first thing that I want to say is that it's very difficult to separate pre-algorithm and post-algorithm in the sense, because this is an assemblage where, we're influenced by the way in which those systems are constructed, and those systems also, shape back, how we think. So, for example, what data reflects is what the machine affords us, in a sense, meaning that you can, there are certain things that are made legible and certain other things that are not, because they're not so easily computable, for example. That logic needs to be addressed as much as issues of representativeness. So, for example, you'll hear policymakers say that data needs to be more representative. We need more data, but this is not enough. So, in the EU AI Act, for example, there is an Article 10 on data governance that requires providers and users of these systems to make sure that these data are correct and representative, but this is far from form enough. So there are issues of legibility, as I said, and there's also issues of training, and this is a whole holistic effort, I would say, that we need to put in. So it's training the caseworkers, but it's also matters how those workers, the working processes of these people. So if you have a caseworker who is under time pressure to make a decision, and there are many other factors, it could be media pressure as well, for example, societal pressure. And so those people tend to follow the algorithmic recommendation because they, for one thing, they interpret it as being more objective, more neutral. That's called automation bias. But there's also a whole set of other pressures, and time pressure is one big factor where they have to make a decision quite quickly. And so this feeds into the process. So this is a question that crosses many different aspects. And it's not only, technical or non-technical solutions, but it's really something holistic that needs to happen.
Yeah, one of the questions I have regarding representativeness of the data is that our society is changing, and it's good that it's changing in some directions. We are becoming less discriminatory. We are becoming more respectful of rights of minorities and discriminated groups. And we want some samples to change. When we think about, for example, college applicants, this is not what we do at Sciences Po. We look at each case by a couple of pairs of human eyes. But imagine that there is a university which gets many more applicants that we are getting now, and as it becomes much easier to apply online, which is a big revolution since COVID, you can imagine that there are universities which are getting tens of thousands, and now some universities will move into hundreds of thousands of applications. Maybe some of them will use AI, the algorithm, to look at the files. And then the question is, how do we make sure that algorithms are actually aware of the existing representative sample of potential applicants? Is the existing potential sample is what we want to have, because it's probably because of discrimination in previous stages of career or life cycle, certain minorities or certain discriminated groups don't get to graduate from good high schools and don't get to apply for college. If we use current representativeness, maybe it's not enough. So if we just stick to representativeness, that pre-algorithmic stage already reinforces discrimination, what can we do about this?
You're touching on a very important and difficult question, which is the normative decision, which should be democratic, right? Of which ground truth do we want to select as our sort of baseline for algorithmic fairness interventions? And so this is regulated in EU law through positive action, the notion of positive action, which is defined quite strictly. And the Court of Justice of the European Union has also been very strict in interpreting the boundaries of what you can do and not do in order to redress past inequalities, right? And so in terms of quotas, it's extremely difficult to see the dividing line between legal or lawful and non-lawful quotas. That's one thing. The other thing I want to say is that whenever you have a policy that redresses racism, sexism, and many other vectors of inequalities, defining that ground truth and defining that baseline is really key. But my argument would be to say, you know, there is no neutral status quo, because if we choose things as they are, they also reflect inaccuracies and you know, injustices that cannot be redressed through more representation, because you end up representing what is already there, right? Which is a status quo that is inherently discriminatory. So we need to go further than that. This is why we need positive action. But the law being as it is, it's very difficult to adopt meaningful positive action decisions that are lawful at the same time. So my argument would be to say, we don't only have a duty to refrain from discrimination, we actually have a positive obligation to prevent discrimination from being maintained in the future. And Deborah Hellman and Sophia Moreau are moral philosophers who have worked on these questions. And what they say is that, you know, every one of us has a responsibility to discontinue discrimination. And I think this is key when we talk about AI.
I think that's a very strong argument that status quo is actually unequal, and in order to depart from the discriminatory status quo, we need to have a positive discrimination. That was banned recently by Supreme Court in the US for American universities. And the issue is here, exactly as you said, who gets to decide on dimensions of quota and actually on quantitative indicators embedded into quotas. I'll give you an example, which is probably most visible example, for which we probably don't need algorithms. But in corporate boardrooms, which is a very powerful part of European and American elites, there is always a push for diversity. CEOs of big companies in the US and Europe are mostly men, mostly exclusively men. And in the last 10, 15 years, most corporations started to impose diversity quotas for the board members. And the question here is that you should have at least 30% of women, or 30% of each gender, or 40% of each gender. And the question is very clear. Why do we know that it should be just one gender? And the second question is, once we decide that we talk about binary gender, which is by now already not very obvious, right? For most people, it's clear that that's a very limited understanding of what gender is. But if we already decide that we talk about binary gender, who gets to decide 20-40%? For a corporation, that's private business, that's the decision of shareholders. For a regulator of corporations, that's already political decision. And so somebody among politicians needs to take action. When we talk about composition of party electoral tickets, how many men and women should be on this ticket, do we need a proper representation of other discriminated minorities? Well, women are not a minority. Other discriminated groups. Who gets to decide? Do we need political parties who have to think about this and make proposals to voters? Should we promote information about the impacts of those decisions to voters? How does this process work now?
Coming back to the question of AI and algorithmic systems, I think this is an extremely important question, because at the moment, this decision relies or lies in the hands of technologists. So the industry has been working on ethical solutions to, you know, problems of unfairness. But this then escapes democratic review in a way, because, you know, it's a private decision that is driven by technical considerations, considerations of technical affordances, but also profit-making considerations. And I think that this is extremely important, that society has a say in that, and it obviously should go through, you know, political debate and political discussions, but also the law has a say in that. So the law is also constraining in the ways it constructs categories. You were speaking about gender. What European law says is, you know, the underrepresented sex. So it doesn't say men and women. But the question that is important here is, what do we mean by equality? Very often, people have an understanding of equality that is symmetrical. So formal treatment or equal treatment of two bodies that are similarly situated is equality. But equality goes actually much further than that, and it's also recognized in discrimination law. There are situations where you should treat people who are not in a similar situation in a different manner. And this form of asymmetrical equality consists, for example, in positive action. And my argument is to say, you know, these forms of fairness interventions need to be discussed politically, democratically, and they need to be subjected to judicial review.
Yes, this is a good point, and we are very happy to be in Europe, where we already have Digital Services Act, which will advance transparency of algorithm, which is something which I consider as a big step forward, exactly for the reasons you mentioned, that society will institute transparency and accountability of technological companies, and therefore will be better aware of the biases which are embedded in those algorithms, which are trained indeed to maximize profits. There is nothing wrong with maximizing profits, but the job of regulators is also to protect common good. In a technical sense, so suppose I need to recruit a person for a big corporation. I got several thousand people applying. So I use an algorithm which predicts whether this or that candidate with this or that characteristic will succeed in this job. As you rightly said, this algorithm is probably trained on previous decades of data. So it's a prediction which would work well in pre-equality society. And in that particular pre-algorithmic society, men would have higher chances to succeed. So we have asymmetric situation, as you rightly said. So I need to adjust the algorithm. So I need to talk to technicians, to software engineers. Women should get higher chance because the data are biased against women. Now, the question is, by how much? What is the magic number? Do I need to change the algorithm by 10%, 15%, 2%? How do we know that? What are researchers suggesting regarding this?
This is always the question that, as a researcher in law, I am confronted with when I talk to people in the tech sector. And it's a question that you cannot answer or respond to with a number. This is because it's a question of social engineering. This is what the law does, right? To a certain extent, it engineers how society should look like. And this is also what technologies do. So, for example, there is one famous case that is always invoked in every research about algorithmic discrimination. The famous company, Amazon, not to cite it, developed a prototype to screen CVs. And it ended up excluding women almost exclusively, and so almost systematically. And so what happened is researchers tried to fix it, but this was based on decades of previous decisions that were themselves discriminatory. And there, you know, you cannot answer to that question by, you know, inputting an algorithmic quota. It's a problem that has its roots much, much further in society. So it lies in, you know, stereotypes about women being unable to enter STEM fields, science, not having a brain for math, for example. So all those decisions are not only, or all those stereotypes are not only symbolic, they have a material effect as well, because women choose careers that tend not to be in STEM and then end up not working in AI development, for example. So you have this issue of representation, but you also have an issue of training. And I think in order to redress that, we need to address the roots of the issue, which are also in our brains, right? We need to to learn how to dismantle those stereotypes and how to create favorable conditions for AI development to not be unequal. There's one more example that I wanted to give you. So for example, if you train an algorithm to recruit people who are good leaders, right? You would use a series of proxies to come to your variable, to what you seek, which is leadership. But we know that leadership is an extremely loaded male characteristic, right? So it's difficult to say, you know, women are good leaders. They are often perceived as aggressive or as too assertive. So even the way you frame your problem, so to say, influences the future discriminatory outcomes of your algorithms.
Yes, it's a good example. And the question there about the life cycle of discrimination, you cannot become a CEO unless you go to the business school. You cannot become a CEO of tech company unless you go into STEM discipline. And that you don't want to do because you know that women never end up of being CEOs of technological companies or global multinational companies. And for that, we need role models. And this is what positive discrimination can actually achieve with quotas. The more successful women are at the top, the more girls today are incited, are incentivized to go into STEM disciplines or to go to the business schools or other disciplines which are currently dominated by men. And in that sense, positive discrimination can work. But to get back to my question about CVs and numerical adjustment of the algorithm, I still don't fully understand why wouldn't that work. So if we just say, okay, we do positive discrimination, like those quotas, like adjustment in the algorithm, so women are getting more weight when the algorithm spits out a number. Before the final number, it also adjusts a recommendation by whatever, 5% or 10%. Or why won't that work? How we should think about those issues. In order to create role models, we need to appoint women in certain senior positions. In order to appoint women, we need to adjust the algorithm in a positive discrimination direction. So this should work somehow, right?
I don't think the question is why won't that work. The question is rather who gets to decide on that number? This is a highly political decision because you're touching on a definition of fairness on which there is absolutely no consensus. So some people will argue for equality of opportunity. So we give everyone the same chances. We adjust for obstacles on, you know, their path or their professional career. But some others will say, you know, as you're rightly saying now, we need a sort of provisional equality of outcomes policy in order to craft the positive examples that will serve as role models later. And so because there is no political consensus on the definition of fairness, it's difficult to say what it means to adjust an algorithm. So, you know, what do we want? How do we want society to look like? This is the question you're asking. It goes much further than just adjusting a technical system in a particular circumstance.
I expected you to give me an answer. What kind of society do we want here in Europe? What are the European policymakers' vision of the fair society we are building here in Europe? That's the question I'm asking you.
That's a very broad question, but I would say that it goes much further than looking into algorithms. We need a systematic and holistic policy that redresses for obstacles along the way. So if you think about the case of women, for example, the fact that, you know, there is a gender pay gap that is about 13% on average in the EU at the moment, that maternity policies are not allowing women to, you know, fully participate in the labor market as their male counterparts do. So all of this creates and maintains structural inequalities, which sometimes are difficult to see, but if we don't address them, there will be no algorithmic fairness, because this is, you know, a socio-technical question once again, and there is no technical solution to that. So the trap is always to say, you know, okay, techno-solutionism, give me the magic number. Unfortunately, the answer to that is much more multifaceted and much more political.
Yes, as an economist, I can confirm that the current consensus on the economics of gender discrimination, gender equality, is that motherhood penalty is something that is a major remaining factor in gender pay gap and differential outcomes of genders in economic performance, the same as STEM. You mentioned STEM. This is also one of the issues which has not been addressed in our economic inequality agenda when we talk about gender inequality, and this is, of course, not what algorithm can help you with. But since we mentioned Europe so many times, and it's great that Europe is working on Digital Services Act, it's great that Europe is working on AI Act, why is that Europe and not nation states? Why is not the member state France, which has much more power in certain issues than European Commission or European Parliament, why is that at a European level at which we need to address those issues?
Mm-hmm. So in Europe, you know, there is a framework, coming back now to the question of discrimination, there's a framework that harmonizes national legislation on discrimination. It prohibits mainly six criteria, which is sex, race or ethnic origin, religion or belief, age, sexual orientation, and disability. Now, member states can go further than that. So France has more than 20 prohibited criteria of discrimination. But what I'm trying to say here is that Europe has the harmonizing force, so to say. And so some member states only comply with EU law, some others go further, which is why this framework, first of all, needs to be up to speed. There is now an issue because if online discrimination is prohibited, for example, in, you know, goods and services that you can buy online, this is prohibited on grounds of sex and on grounds of race. But it's not on grounds of disability at European Union level. So this discrimination legislation has a lot of gaps that need to be addressed. The other dimension of that is the internal market. So the rationale for Europe to adopt AI legislation at the moment is to make sure that innovation can flow in the internal market, right? There's also questions of, you know, the Brussels effect, normative exportation, so to say, from Europe to the outside. But so in that sense, because of that harmonizing power, Europe, you know, should really invest in scrutinizing fundamental rights legislation and how it articulates with AI-specific sectoral regulation like the DSA, like the AI Act.
So Europe is providing a lowest common denominator. So the minimum criteria which protect discriminated groups And then you mentioned the Brussels effect, which is a concept formed after GDPR came into force, General Data Protection Regulation, which initially was supposed to be a European regulation, but was then exported to many other markets, which decided that it's easier to copy European rules rather than to develop and struggle with their own regulations. To what extent do you think the same will happen with the acts we are talking about right now, DSA, which already comes into effect this year, and AI Act, which will soon be adopted, we hope. To what extent do you think the vested interests in other countries may prevent the global spread of these important regulations, which can help address the issue of algorithmic discrimination?
I think that a lot of countries are looking at Europe. So, for example, you mentioned the example of the GDPR. I know that Chile at the moment is you know, looking into data protection legislation using the GDPR as a sort of framework. And I think to some extent, the same will happen with the AI Act. But of course, even in Europe, not only outside Europe, the way in which the industry has been trying to influence some of the major provisions of the AI Act, if you think about generative AI, for example, can be problematic. And civil society organizations have called for a harm-based approach and a rights-based approach instead of a risk-based approach, arguing that the measuring the risks is, or preventing the risks is much more difficult than legally preventing the harms from happening and the rights that should be protected.
Yes, I was asking mostly about United States and China, which may or may not want to import European legislation such as DSA and AI Act. The US has different structural elements of protecting freedom of speech than Europe does. China has a very different approach to freedom of speech and protecting privacy. Are you optimistic or pessimistic regarding regulating algorithms in these big markets? These are not just big markets more generally, but these are big markets for AI, because these are indeed the countries where most of development of AI is now located. And these are the places on which, on whose data these algorithms are being trained. So these are of primary importance to the issue of algorithmic discrimination. Do you think they will be happy to adopt European regulation anytime soon?
I'm rather pessimistic, but for different reasons, and mainly because the latest position of the Council on the AI Act...
Of the European Council.
Of the Council of Ministers, doesn't necessarily reflect what the European Parliament had said. And so I think that the European Parliament was much more aware of the rights problematic and the fundamental rights protection than the Council has been in the European Union. And so there is a double language here. So that as I mentioned, you know, the risk language doesn't necessarily reflect the concerns of people like me who work on algorithmic discrimination. And the question is, how will this be implemented? How will this be reviewed? So we're talking a lot about technical standards. We know that technical standards are not necessarily very democratic in the way they are developed. And, you know, the other question is, to what extent will they be meaningfully reviewable, judicially reviewable by the Court of Justice, for example? And so there's a lot at stake in the translation of legal concerns, ethical concerns, into technical standards. There's a process here which is mainly dominated by the industry, and I'm puzzled by, you know, what this will hide in terms of normative trade-offs. And I think this is a key area of research, but also one that is extremely difficult to permeate, so to say, because of lack of access, but also because we don't speak the same language, right? The language of the law and the language of technology are very different languages. A lot of the times we rely on analogies. So we say, for example, the law needs to catch up with tech developments. We need an AI, a human-centric approach to AI. And those analogies hide the ways in which, tech developments or tech discourses displace the epistemological foundations of discrimination law. Just to give you one example, the subject of non-discrimination law is the protected group or the protected person. So it can be someone victim of racism or a group victim of sexism. But the algorithmic subject is an entirely different subject. It's something based on correlations and proxies, something based on homophily and proximity that does not necessarily recognize itself as a public or as a subject, and in any case, not as a legal subject. So there are entire epistemological issues in this transposition of the law to new technological developments, which I think the AI Act doesn't address.
Thank you very much. I also remain pessimistic in the sense that AI demands very highly skilled individuals. And while legal scholars are available on both sides of the debate, in civil society, in governments, in universities, and in the private sector, the highly skilled technological, the algorithm designers, they're very hard to recruit as they remain in the private sector. And therefore, when we talk about European Court of Justice, for example, when you think about expertise, technical expertise on this, that is also going to be difficult to see how easily the court will understand what algorithm, evolution of algorithm involves in particular cases. And as you rightly said, in theory, we understand the difference between algorithmic discrimination and discrimination by humans. But once we enter into the detail, we also need technical expertise, which is not always available for the public sector, as these individuals are very highly paid and often recruited by the private companies. Let me thank you, Rafael, for this very interesting, even though very concerning conversation. There are many things to worry about, unfortunately, but there are also good news in the sense that there are new pieces of legislation coming, and the overall European approach is based on non-discrimination and even positive discrimination. And that is all for now. And stay tuned for the next episode of Sciences Po Research Podcast. In this season, we talk about technological transformation and its implication for our societies, for our political and economic processes. Sciences Po.